Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Welcome to the second instalment of Holy Mothers of God. Before we get started on the stories of Ruth and Bathsheba, we are thinking, yesterday we thought specifically about sex work. Today we're thinking a bit more about marriage. So my question for you is, and if you can turn to the people next to you and have a little chat, why do people get married and why do people stay married? All right, let's see where we've gotten to. So, why do people get married and why do people stay married? To pool resources. What kinds of resources are we pooling here? Money? Tax benefits? Intellectual resources. Can you say a bit more about that?
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes it's a little bit, so I'm an academic, and one of the things that you notice a lot in academic books is that you'll find at the beginning of books written by men, a little thing where they say, thanks to my wife, who basically wrote the book for me. So it's not always quite an equal sharing of resources, but there's a pooling of resources sometimes. Anything else? Inertia. Okay, so because everybody else gets married, because you get in a relationship and you're like, well, might as well get married. Oh, you stay married because of inertia. Okay, yeah. Yeah. So some people get married and stay married because of inertia. Some people get married and stay married because it's great. It is actually quite difficult to get divorced. I don't know if you learned that. So you can say it's because of unreasonable behaviour, not very clear what that is, or because one person has committed adultery, in which case the divorce paperwork gets sent to the named third party who has to sign it off. Or you have to be separated for 2 years. So it's kind of like it's designed to make it as difficult as possible to get divorced, which may or may not be a good thing, depending on how you think about these things. Any other reasons why people get and stay married? At the back there. Sorry. To lock it down. Yes. For love. Controversial. just behind you. Peer pressure. Yep. Central heating. I don't know if you've ever lived in a flat without central heating, but I have a lot of empathy for that motivation for marriage. Yeah. Visa reasons. Yeah, absolutely. Getting kind of difficult now, right? Like, I think, is it already or is it about to be that you can't bring your foreign partner over unless you're earning over 36,000 or something? So increasingly, that's an option that's available to rich people and not to everybody else. At the back there. Yeah. Some societies expect it. So if you're not married, people will start saying, why aren't you married? What's wrong with you? That's a pressure that seems to tend to fall more heavily on women than it does on men. Yeah, at the back. Yeah. Well, if you get sick of people in church asking you when you're married and getting children, problem is if you get married, then they start asking you when you're going to have children. So I don't know what happens after you get children. What's the question that comes next? Lots of different questions. Have you finished yet? Are you done? By the stone at the back. Sex. Better to marry than burn, isn't it? Thanks, Paul. Amber.
I got married because I wanted to
because you want to move out of your parents and you can't afford to live somewhere on your own. Interestingly, millennials are getting married at lower rates than the generations preceding us. But I do know lots of people who've like moved in very quickly with partners because it's difficult to afford London rents. I don't know if that hits anyone here. So there's a bunch, some stuff about some things are cheaper when you're married. When there's two of you, rent is cheaper. Lots of things are kind of cheaper when there's more of you. So there's some kind of financial incentives as well as the tax benefits. So many. Hand down there. To find somebody else who goes to Greenbelt. Do you not have to find out that they go to Greenbelt before you marry them? Or do you like convert them afterwards? So to have someone to go to Greenbelt with. Yes, down here. Security for children. Yeah. And so I'm just repeating things for the recording. So a daughter had a short-term marriage to a Shia boy because that was the only way that they could go steady. A medievalist once told me, and I've not been able to track down the reference to this, that in medieval England, there were a range of different marriage contracts where, because marriage wasn't kind of formalised in a church then, and one was the marriage of the hedge, which was essentially where you were like married, but just for the night. But it was a kind of legally recognised thing in some sense. Okay, so there's lots of different reasons why people get married. I feel like as Christians, we often talk about the stuff to do with sex and love and romance. We don't talk so much about the fact that marriage is also about organising property. It's about organising who owns stuff. So you share your property with your spouse. You inherit your property from your parents. You pass your property on to your children. Having that incentive to pass wealth on, I think, is one of the reasons why people are resistant to the idea of inheritance tax. So it's one of the things that holds, that kind of perpetuates financial inequality. It's also about the way that we organise production. So what you find is that lots of different societies organise gender differently, but often one of the things that gender indexes is a division of labour. So there are some jobs that women do more than men. There are some jobs that men do more. And so marriage and the family are kind of ways of organising production. We tend to have quite small family units. Lots of other societies, including earlier European societies, had more kind of extended families, which were about getting enough people together that you could kind of run your homestead or produce whatever it was that you were producing. So marriage has never only been about love. And actually, for a lot of history, it hasn't really been very much about love at all. In medieval Europe, for example, love was what you felt for the person you were adulterously lusting after, and absolutely not the thing you felt for the person you were married to, who was a kind of political or practical decision. So bearing that in mind, let us think about the story of Ruth. We're going to talk about the book of Ruth. It's quite long, so I thought it was probably best not to just read the whole story out. But I figured that probably, I know that Greenbelt has a reputation for being less Bible-focused than some other places, but I'm hoping that between us, we can more or less reconstruct what happens in the book of Ruth. So does anyone remember how the book of Ruth opens? What's the start of the story? Famine. Yeah, so what role does famine play in the story? Yeah.
It's the famine that drives Naomi and her family to
move. Yeah, so the book opens in the days when the judges ruled. There was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So Elimelech and Naomi and their two sons move to Moab. The two sons get married. And then what happens? They die. So I think, does anyone know what the Bechdel test is? So the Bechdel test is a way of kind of testing whether or not a piece of art or culture is representing women, particularly kind of films. And the Bechdel test, so it's a kind of basic, like, do you sort of recognise that women exist and have lives? And to pass the Bechdel test, a story has to have at least two women who have names, who have a conversation with each other that isn't about a man. And I think, I might be wrong, but I haven't yet found any evidence to the contrary. I think that this is the only story in the Bible that passes the Bechdel test. And the reason that it happens is because all of the men are dead. So that's interesting. Elimelech and Naomi move to Moab. The boys get married. Elimelech dies. The sons die. So we're left with Naomi and her two daughters-in-law. What happens then? The famine ends. It doesn't actually say whether the famine has ended or not. So Naomi's setting off because she hears in the country of Moab that the Lord had consideration for his people and had given them food. So they're about to set out off back to the land of Judah. And what happens then? She sends her daughter. She tries to send her daughters-in-law home. And then what happens? So there's two daughters. There's Orpah and Ruth. Orpah decides that she's going to go back to her mother's house, which is interesting because usually houses belong to fathers. I don't know if just all of the men in general are dead here. But Naomi says, go back to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you. Orpah goes home and Ruth says, I'm not going to go home. I'm going to come with you. And then there's this famous thing that Ruth says. She says, do not press me to leave you or turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you. So Ruth has decided that she's going to throw her lot in with Naomi, go back with her to the land of Judah. So the text doesn't say why she's doing that. Does anyone have any theories? Gay, popular theory. So probably a little bit of an age gap, probably nothing insurmountable. Maybe they just love each other. So this is a popular reading at lesbian weddings for that reason. Any other theories? Yeah. Worried about Naomi being older and on her own. So Naomi doesn't have anybody to support her. She doesn't have any male kin. And when they get to Judah, Ruth essentially is supporting both her and Naomi. So it might be that Ruth was worried about whether Naomi would have any means of supporting herself. Yes. Saw something in Naomi that she admired. So it might have been a story about love between women that isn't sexual, but they just really love each other and they want to kind of continue living together. Yes, in the blue. Maybe Ruth's parents didn't like that she married a foreigner and didn't want her back. Yeah. Yeah, so she might have been interested in Naomi's God. The prayer kind of explicitly evokes God, and maybe it is that she's found something about Naomi's faith in God that she finds appealing. Yes. So there's some possibility that if she goes back with Naomi, she might be able to find a husband, which is in fact what happens. So she maybe thinks her chances of getting married are better in Judah than they are back in Moab. Anything else? Yeah. Obligated to her dead husband to look after his mum. So we've got lots of possible reasons. And I want to throw out another possible reason. So there's a really great book by a writer called Laura Maria Agustin, who talks about, she spent a while working in the Global South with women who are trying to migrate to the Global North. And then she moved to the Global North and started working with migrant women there. And she said what really struck her was the difference between her experience of working in the Global South. And she said that she found that the women she was working with had all sorts of different reasons for wanting to migrate. And then she got to the Global North. And all of the stories were essentially about trafficking, about necessity. And one of the things she does is she talks about the difference between the way we talk about tourism and travelling and being an expat and migration. And she says that when we talk about tourism, your kind of archetypal tourist is a rich white man who wants to travel the world, see the sights, experience different cultures. And when we talk about migrants, we assume that they're driven by necessity, by need. We typify them in ways that are feminine. They need to come, they need to work, they need to support their families. And so she says that... But actually, if you talk to women who are migrating from the global south, they have all the same reasons that, you know, like your teenagers going off on a gap year do. Sometimes they're moving because of necessity. Sometimes they're moving because they need to support their family. Sometimes they're moving because they just want to get out of the tiny little town they've grown up in and see the world. They want to experience different cultures. They want to go and have a different kind of experience of the world. And one of the things that's interesting, this is the only story in the Bible where we have a woman migrating into Israel, and it's not because she's married. But what you find in lots of stories is Israelite men traveling outside of Israel, going down into Cana, often to try and find a wife. But it seems like sometimes they just are interested. They want to kind of go travel somewhere else. And so I'd like to throw out the possibility that one of the things going on with Naomi might be that she's curious. She just wants to see the world. She wants to know what Judah is like. So there's a whole different set of reasons that we could attribute to her. It might be that she is... So Moab has this kind of fraught relationship to Israel. Israel sometimes seems like it's a kind of colonizing violent force in Moab. So she might be trying to escape colonial violence. It might be out of economic necessity. This is clearly a world in which famines happen. She might be bored. She might just be really bored of Moab. I don't know if you've ever felt that about the places that you live in. It might be that she loves Naomi, that love is platonic, or that love is sexual. It might be that she's trying to escape abusive men in her family. It might be out of familial love, out of this sense of obligation to Naomi. And it might be that she wants to see more of the world. Or it might be some combination of all of those different things, because people are rich and complicated and have rich and complicated lives. And we're not always good at thinking about that when we talk about these stories about migration. I wanted to read you a quote from, so there's an organisation of sex workers in Thailand called the Empower Foundation, and I have this quote from one of the women who's involved in that organisation, and she says, "If this was a story of a man setting out on an adventure to find a treasure and slay a dragon to make his family rich and safe, he would be the hero. But I am not a man. I am a woman, and so the story changes. I cannot be the family provider. I cannot be setting out on an adventure. I am not brave and daring. I am not resourceful and strong. Instead, I am called illegal, disease spreader, prostitute, criminal, or trafficking victim." So, for whatever reasons, Ruth decides that she's going to leave Moab and go back to Judah. What happens when she gets back to Israel? She does farm work. So she goes out into the fields and she gleans. So the Hebrew Bible says that when you harvest your crops, you're supposed to leave the bits around the edge for the poor to go and gather them up. And so that's what Naomi does. Like lots of contemporary migrants, she ends up doing pretty miserable, sort of backbreaking agricultural labour. After a while, it seems like this wears thin. So what does Ruth do next? She sends to her kinsman Boaz. And actually, I missed out a little bit of the story, because as Naomi is gleaning in the fields, as Ruth is gleaning in the fields, Ruth has sent her to glean in Boaz's field. So Boaz is a relative. Why does Naomi send Ruth to Boaz's field? So the men won't harass her. So Boaz at some point says to Ruth, he says, "Make sure you don't go and glean in another field. Keep close to my young women. I have ordered the young men not to bother you." So this is clearly a context in which something like sexual harassment is a problem, as it is for lots of migrant workers today, as it is for lots of migrant workers doing agricultural work. I don't know if any of you saw, there was a really heartbreaking story in the States recently where ICE did a massive raid on a food processing plant and separated lots of parents from their children, put them in detention centres. And it emerged not long after that story broke that one of the things that had happened in that food processing plant was that some of the workers had just won a case about sexual harassment in the processing plant. And so it seemed like the immigration raid was retaliation for women pushing back against sexual harassment. And what you often find in contexts where migrants are working, sometimes because people are working illegally, sometimes because they just don't know the laws of the country, that all kinds of abuses are really common, and sexual harassment is really common. And because of the kinds of racist narratives we tell about people of colour, and particularly women of colour, there's often a kind of sexualisation of migrants that leaves them really open to sexual harassment. And it seems like something similar is going on in the land of Israel. So Boaz helps Ruth. He protects her. It's not clear whether he's protecting her just because she's a friend of Naomi's. So I don't know if there are other women out there gleaning in the field who don't get Boaz's protection. The text doesn't tell us. So she spends a while gleaning in the fields. What happens after she's been gleaning in the fields for a while? She goes and tucks herself under Boaz's blanket. So she goes. So Naomi says, "I need to seek some security for you, so it may be well with you." And Naomi tells Ruth that Boaz is going to be sleeping in the on the threshing floor that night. She tells Naomi to go and dress herself up, not to make herself known to Boaz, but to go and once he's fallen asleep, to go and lie down and uncover his feet. And lie down. I don't really understand how Hebrew innuendo works. Apparently that might be an innuendo. It feels like a weird one, right? Uncover his feet. So scholars are sort of a little bit divided on like whether that is whether she's uncovering his feet or just uncovering his feet. Sorry. So... Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts. If you're interested in this, there's a great article by a scholar called Roland Bohr called "The Patriarch's Nuts," which explores testicle imagery in the Hebrew Bible. And my favourite thing about this article is that he says at the beginning that he's not going to use the same word for testicles twice. So you get to learn about Hebrew. Apparently loins, you know, there's lots of language about loins, and that strongly implies also testicles. So you get to learn some more about that rich vein of Hebrew imagery. And you also get a whole load of alternative words for testicles. I did not know that there were so many in the world. So there's a treat for you if you want to go and hunt it out. Ruth goes and she lies down in the threshing floor. Why do you think that she's doing this? This is a really weird way to try and proposition someone, right? What's that about? Because it's public. Say a bit more about that. Yeah, so she's kind of making it public. So she's forcing Boaz to make a decision. And probably what would have happened is, so Boaz has two choices when he finds her lying down by his seat. Either he can say, "I'm going to honour my obligation as a kinsman." So it seems like, again, we talked a bit yesterday about levirate marriage. So this idea that if a man in the family dies, you're supposed to marry the woman off to someone related so that she can kind of carry on that man's line but also find protection. So there's something about levirate marriage going on here. So Boaz has the option of sort of saying, "I will marry you, I'll offer you kind of financial security and protection." What do you think would have happened if he hadn't done that? She's now a whore in the eyes of society and fair game for everyone. So it seems like she's risking her reputation. Whether or not anything happens between Ruth and Boaz, if everyone else finds out that she spent the night on the threshing floor with Boaz, they will assume that something untoward has happened. Her reputation will probably be ruined. And it's interesting, actually, if we think about what happened to Tamar. So Tamar goes, she sleeps with Judah, and because she's pretending to be a sex worker because she's asking for payment, she ends up with Boaz's Judah's seal and rope, so that when he accuses her of being a whore and says that she should be burned, she can be like, "Oh, well, you were the one who got me pregnant," and produce the proof of that. Rahab is kind of fine because she's got her own house, she owns her own family, so she's not putting her reputation at risk in the same way when she lets the Israelite spies into her house. But it's hard not to think that if Boaz had decided that actually he just really didn't want to marry Ruth, maybe he's got his eyes on someone else, maybe he just doesn't want the hassle of having a wife, maybe he's just not a nice person, he could have just destroyed her reputation, left her vulnerable to all kinds of violence. And so it's interesting that insofar as Ruth is relying on marriage rather than sex work, she's actually more vulnerable in certain ways than either Tamar or Rahab was. So fortunately, Boaz turns out to be a good man. He says he's going to marry Ruth. How does the story kind of wrap up? There's some like really boring stuff where they go to the gate and there's some stuff with like... Sorry. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So for the people who didn't hear, so it seems like there's someone who has a kind of a better claim to be the person who should marry Ruth. So you have to go through this thing where he sort of says he's going to give up his claim to be the person who would get to marry Ruth. And it seems like probably because Naomi has directed Ruth towards Boaz, that probably Boaz seems like the better bet. Maybe he's richer. Maybe he's just a more trustworthy guy. So there's some kind of complex maneuvering. And actually, there's a recent book by a Jewish scholar who sort of tracks what she calls the line of the messianic mothers. So the women who essentially sort of ensure the continuation of the genealogy up to David. And she says that what you see over the women leading up to David is a kind of, right at the beginning, you have Lot's daughters who get their father drunk and sleep with him in order to get pregnant. And there's this kind of sense of competition between women. And she says that what you see in the story of Ruth and Naomi is a kind of reconciliation. There's loads of stories earlier in the Hebrew Bible where women are at each other's throats, where they're competing, where they're trying to double cross each other. And what you see here is two women working together to protect one another. To take care of one another. And this is one of the ways that women survive in patriarchal societies, right? We have whisper networks to let you know, like, who can't be trusted. We sort of give people tips on how to be better at seducing people. There's all sorts of kind of complex maneuverings that go on. And one of the things that's interesting around laws about sex workers in the UK, so it's not illegal to sell sex in the UK, but a bunch of things associated with sex work are criminalised. And so one of the things that happens now is that if you have two women working together for safety to look out for one another, that counts as pimping, and so those women can be prosecuted. So it's interesting that we, and you know, like both in terms of dealing with marriage, both in terms of dealing with sex work, women's care for one another is really crucial to kind of survival. But it's also something that we currently criminalise in the UK. Okay, so Boaz and Ruth get married. How does the story end? There's a baby. A child is born to Ruth. And interestingly, what the story says is, so Boaz takes Ruth, she becomes his wife. The Lord makes her conceive and she bears a son. And the women say to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him. And the women of the neighbourhood name the child and they say a son has been born to Naomi, which is really interesting, right? So once again, we had in the story of Tamar, we have a woman who sort of behaves outside of the bounds of respectability, but because what she does, seducing her father-in-law, means that a son is born, so the property can be carry on being passed on, she's more righteous than Onan, who spills his seed on the ground in order to try and kind of break the line of passing the property down from father to son. So we have this kind of idea of righteousness, but the index of Ruth's righteousness is that she's made sure that a son has been born to Naomi. And what you find really interestingly as well is that, so if you remember in the story of Tamar, once Tamar has had a child, the text switches from calling her Tamar to switch it to calling her she and her. So she loses her name. She disappears back into the narrative now that she's ensured that the line is continuing. And what you find at the end of Ruth is really interesting because you sort of have this idea of a kind of matrilineal descent. So this son has been born to Naomi. Ruth is more to her than seven sons. But Ruth, again, disappears back into the narrative. She starts being referred to as she and her. And the book ends with a genealogy of men. It says, now these are the descendants of Perez, who, if you remember, was Tamar's son. And Perez became the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Amminadab, Amminadab of Nahshon, Nahshon of Salmon, Salmon of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed of Jesse, and Jesse of David. So the women have done all of this complex maneuvering. They have cared for one another. They have been family to one another. They have helped one another survive. But what the text does at the end is it wraps it up and it fits it back nicely into this line where the father begets the son and things get passed down in that line. So a few things that I think are interesting about the story of Ruth, and we're going to go and talk about Bathsheba next. So one of the things that's interesting in this story is that everything kind of plays out in a reasonably respectable way, but along that route, for people to get kind of nicely and safely married and tucked back into respectability, women have to risk their reputation in order to keep the institution of marriage going. And I think we're not very good at acknowledging all of the kinds of ways in which the way that marriage actually functions in our society often relies on women behaving badly, women taking risks, women doing all sorts of like slightly dangerous and disrespectable things in order to kind of ensure that things carry on nice and safely. And women pay the price for that. So, you know, we live in a society where we recognise that people are unfaithful, where sex work happens, but the penalty of those things that people do to survive within the system of marriage falls much more heavily on women than it does on men. And again, I think that's because of this, the importance of making sure that property goes from fathers to sons. Another thing I think that is interesting about this story is that we find women helping and protecting one another, but also enforcing norms of respectability. One of the things that Naomi is teaching Ruth is how to do the right thing, how to appear respectable. And I think that it's true that often patriarchy is sustained and perpetuated by men, but I think it's really important that we recognise that women do that work too. Often much more harshly than men do. We judge one another. We make sure that people are kind of staying in line. We gossip about people, if they're about other women, if their behaviour isn't right, if their dress isn't right. And so I think it's really important, if we're talking about this stuff, that we recognise that the role that women play in that. Women teach one another how to kind of negotiate in that system. And sometimes it's about survival, but sometimes it's about ensuring that the system carries on. And I think the other thing to take away is that both marriage and migration are often about providing for people that we love. That what drives people to do these things, to take these risks, to cross these borders, is the desire to kind of protect and provide for people. And again, it's not so much, it's not straightforwardly about love. It's always also about having access to the resources that we need to survive. So, how do we handle the fact that the Moabite marriages are a contravention of the law of Moses? So Israelite men are not supposed to marry Moabite women. Well, we talked yesterday, what you see in the story of Tamar is that the Israelite men do the things they're not supposed to do. They go and marry the Canaanite women. And what the story very strongly suggests is that the problem is not the Canaanite women. It's not the Canaanite women who are leading the men astray. They do that themselves, and the women have to clean up their mess. That's important because I think, so you have this kind of strong thread in the Bible of trying to make sure that Israel does not marry beyond its boundaries. What happens when that gets picked up? So that becomes a metaphor as well. So you have this idea that you need to keep foreigners out. You need to make sure that the people of Israel are kind of racially pure, that you don't get kind of intermarriage. That gets picked up and carried over into Christianity in various different ways. And you see that in the way that we talk about migration. There's been a kind of shift in far-right rhetoric over the last few years, where people increasingly are worrying about Europe's Christian heritage, that if we let people migrate into Europe, we will lose our Christian heritage. And so policing the borders of the people of God often ends up perpetuating patriarchal violence. It often ends up enacting certain kinds of racism and colonialism. And that's something that we'll pick up a bit more tomorrow, this question about how we maintain our borders as Christians and how that ties in with other kinds of borders and other kinds of worries about kind of sexual and racial purity. So, Bathsheba. I've been kind of doing quite a lot of talking, so I'm going to give you like a minute or so just to talk to the people next to you. What can you remember about the story of Bathsheba? All right. Let's see where we've gone to. So how does the story of Bathsheba begin? Bathing on the roof. So Bathsheba takes a bath on the roof and King David catches sight of her. You look at the history of the interpretation of this passage, which is mostly written by men. And what you'll find in these readings of Bathsheba is that for right throughout the history of Christianity, men have read this story. So it says, late one afternoon, David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. This woman was very beautiful. And what you find when men read this text is they say, oh, Bathsheba taking a bath on the roof. What did she think was going to happen? Why would you go and bathe naked on the roof if you weren't trying to convince the king of Israel to murder your husband so he could marry you instead? That's what I think about when I go bathing. How can I seduce someone en route? But the text doesn't say that. It doesn't say why she was bathing. It doesn't suggest that there's anything particularly untoward on the about the bathing. It just says that David sees her and that she's very beautiful. So David sends someone to inquire about her, and he finds that she's Bathsheba and that she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So what happens next? He gets his servants to bring her to him. He sent messengers to fetch her. So what happens? He rapes her. So what the text says is, David sent messengers to fetch her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. And it doesn't say what she was thinking. It doesn't say what she was feeling. It doesn't say, but I think it strongly implies, what happens when the king sends his messengers to fetch you? You probably can't say, actually, I'm all right, I'm just going to stay in my bath. So you probably have to go to the king. And so there's nothing in this text to say suggest that Bathsheba consents to anything that happens to her. But what we do see is that there's this real disparity of power. David sees her, he sends for her, she comes to him, and he lays with her. So he is doing all of the work here. So this does not seem like it's a love story. It doesn't seem like it's a particularly kind of consensual sexual encounter. So then what happens? She gets pregnant. And in this story, so this is 2 Samuel 11 to 12. In this bit of the story, the only thing that Bathsheba does all the way through this story is she sends David a message with three words in. She says, I am pregnant. It's probably two words in the Hebrew, actually, isn't it? So Bathsheba is pregnant by the king. What happens next? He brings him back from the war. So the reason why David is kind of lounging around looking at women bathing on the rooftop is because he sent his armies to war and he's stayed at home. So Uriah the Hittite has gone to war. David calls him back. He does all these things to try and convince Uriah that he wants to go around and visit Bathsheba. So he's clearly trying to cover up what's happened. He says, Uriah comes back, he asks how the war is going. Then Uriah says, go down to your house and wash your feet. Uriah goes, but he stays at the king's house. David says to Uriah, you've just come back from a long journey. Why not go home? And Uriah says, there's still a war going on out there. I'm not going to go home and see my wife. I'm just going to stay here and then head back. As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing. So David says, stay here a little bit longer. And tomorrow I'm going to send you back. So Uriah stays in Jerusalem. David invites him around for dinner, gets him drunk, says, hey, Uriah, maybe go home, see your wife. And he doesn't do it. He goes and he lies on the couch. And so eventually David sends him back to war. Well, how does David send Uriah back to war? Sends him with a note. He put him at the front. So he sends Uriah, his friend, back to war with a note saying to Joab, who's directing the armies of Israel, make sure that you put Uriah right at the front of the battle where the war is thickest so that he will get killed. So the battle happens and Uriah dies. And the message comes back to David. So what happens next? You're going to have to either put your hands up or talk louder because I'm just hearing murmurings. The prophet Nathan goes to him. So a little bit, actually, I wasn't quite right. So Bathsheba doesn't just say and send a note to saying that she's David. Before Nathan comes, when the wife of Uriah, it doesn't name her at this point, when the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. I don't know enough about the kind of mourning rituals to know whether this was a necessity or whether something that she's choosing to do, but she goes into mourning, and when the mourning is over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. And then Nathan comes round. So God sends Nathan the prophet to go and chat to David. What does Nathan say to David? A lot about sheep. So Nathan goes to David and he tells David a little story. And he says, there are two men. One man's very rich. He owns lots of sheep. Another man's very poor. He only owns one sheep, but he really loves that sheep with all his heart. And then at some point, the rich man, hang on. The rich man takes the sheep and the man is left in mourning. So David is told this story and he suddenly realises what he's done and he feels terrible. What does that story suggest about Bathsheba, though? It's property. It's just livestock. So the man really loves the little sheep, but she's a sheep. She's not. It's not his wife. So David then has this big kind of emotional thing. What else happens around this point in the story? The baby dies. So David goes into mourning, he fasts and he prays and he says, I know I've done wrong, but please God, spare my child. But the child is not spared, the child dies. There's a woman called Ian Clements recently wrote a book about the women in Jesus's genealogy. And she says at this point, maybe it was a severe kind of mercy that the child died, because if the child died, Bathsheba would have been constantly surrounded by speculation that the child was not really her own. And I think that says something really horrifying about the ways that we see these things. It was better for the child to die than for Bathsheba to have this reputation as kind of a tainted woman. So it's pretty grim. And so what you get, David gets very sad. He does all this mourning. He does all these psalms. Then obviously lots of people are like, David, what a great man of God. He sinned. He really repented. We too, when we really sin, can really repent and then God will forgive us and it'll all be great again. And Bathsheba doesn't really get to do anything in this story. We don't hear what her emotional reactions are. We don't have any psalms that she wrote about how she felt about all of this. We just have nothing, just absolute silence. David consoles Bathsheba. He gets her pregnant again. And then she gives birth to Solomon. And what you do find is later on in the text, Bathsheba gets to do some stuff. And what she gets to do is some kind of complex maneuvering to make sure that it's her son who inherits the kingship from David. So again, this story ends with you've ensured the line of succession. The property will be passed on from the father and the son. What do you think this story tells us about marriage? It's about covering up your mistake. It's about covering up your mistake. Women are a commodity. The only important thing is the child who carries on the line. Women have no status except as daughter, wife, and then mother. Most of the power is with the husband, so this is not a kind of partnership between equals.
Even the husband's power is limited. It's limited by his social power.
Yeah, so again, we saw that Rahab's position as a sex worker gave her a certain amount of agency in relation to her family, but she was still caught up in these kind of broader systems of power that she couldn't get out of and was still kind of trying to negotiate with. So the kinds of power that you get in marriage is bound up with other kinds of power. And what you find in the Bible is that the authority of the king is often spoken about in language of family. So, and you find this in the history of the modern West, that we think about a lot of the language that we use for government is language that we take from family. So the way that power works in the family is always kind of nested within the way that power works in society more broadly, and often kind of mirrors it. So you get this kind of analogy in early modern political philosophy between the king understood as kind of the father of the nation and the father understood as the kind of king of the household. So this is obviously a context in which polygamy is the order of the day. It's interesting, when we talk as Christians about marriage, we assume that marriage is always the same thing. And I don't think marriage is always the same thing, because marriage is a way, if it's a way of organising relationships between family members, it's a way of organising property, it's a way of organising inheritance. And different societies do those things differently and have different kind of marriage organisations that reflect that. And so I think, I don't know if any of you were at Greenbelt a few years ago and Miranda Threlfall-Holmes said, well, we defined in the Bible in the institution of marriage is so different than what the institution of marriage is today that we shouldn't treat the biblical passages about marriage as though they're talking about the same thing. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration because obviously our ideas about what marriage is come from the Bible in lots of ways. But I do think that we need to think a bit more carefully about the role that marriage plays within the way of organising society. The kind of ideal of marriage that we associate with Christian family values, for example, is a very particular form of marriage that emerges in the sort of early 20th century, this kind of idea of the nuclear family. Actually, that isn't how the family works in a lot of history. And I think we need to get better at thinking about the ways that our ideas about how marriage should work, about what marriage should be like, about how relationships within the family work, they shift and change as society shifts and changes. And I think that one of the reasons, for example, that fewer millennials are getting married is to do with stuff that's going on in terms of the way that we organise property and power. Work is becoming more precarious. People are moving around more. People don't have as much money. And so this isn't just about morality. It's about the resources that people have access to. One of the factors that was going on in my breakup with my partner was that we both had careers and it was really difficult for us to live in the same city. And I think we're not very good at talking about the ways that this stuff around jobs, around work, around housing affects our ideas about what is and isn't acceptable within marriage. So, just to wrap up this bit, one of the things I think that this story suggests is we often see marriage as the solution to problems of sexual respectability, sex work, and sexual violence. But actually, I think we need to recognise that often marriage is the place where women and children are least safe and most vulnerable. Most child abuse happens within the context of the family. Most interpartner violence happens within the context of the family. And insofar as marriage is about property relations rather than about love between people, it doesn't leave a lot of room for women to do anything, because when marriage is about property, women become part of that. And it becomes really important to ensure that there are sons and that the sons are really the sons of the fathers. And women kind of bear the brunt of all of that stuff. And I think the other thing that's interesting about both of these stories is that women do a lot of work to get married, to hold marriages together. But that work often goes to prop up the very system that makes them vulnerable. So what we see in these stories, Bathsheba doesn't do anything wrong. She doesn't do anything. And it doesn't make her safe. She's married. All she does is she goes and has a bath. And all of this violence unfolds around her. These systems are kind of part of the ways that this violence happens. Insofar as women are kind of doing all the kinds of work that Ruth and Naomi are doing to help one another get married, to help one another find these kinds of securities, we're also inescapably kind of putting one another at risk because that system of marriage continues to be one that harms people. I don't think it's necessarily all bad. Something I think about a lot, there's a theologian called Ted Jennings, and he says, if we have any hope for thinking about marriage as a partnership between two equal people, that hope is something that is offered to us by gay marriage. Because only in gay marriage, he says, do we see the possibility of thinking about marriage in a way that isn't primarily about property relations. So I'm going to leave you with that thought, and I'm going to invite you to come back with me tomorrow, and we're going to talk about Mary, who's the fifth of the women in Jesus's genealogy, and then we're going to reflect a bit about what those five stories together tell us about sex, about holiness, and about what it means to be a Christian. So thanks so much, everybody. I will see you then.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.